session number 19040, Reel 3.
Duckworth Reel 3.
So you
were talking about the period in the occupation of Germany on the Kiel Canal.
Yes.
Did that last very long?
We stayed there until... I can't be sure. I should have thought until the autumn. I think that's right. And then we pulled back into a barracks in Itzehoe.
Did you have any problems in occupying Germany?
No. No, it was all done very peacefully, really. We did have one extraordinary incident when we had a marvellous sergeant major of B Squadron, an old pre-war cavalryman with a great wit and an enormous sense of humour. And B Squadron were controlling one of the bridges over the Kiel Canal. And we were stopping people going north because there were people, might be Nazis, leaders who were escaping to Denmark and beyond. And one day this Mercedes arrived, a spanking new Mercedes with a trailer, and all absolutely chock-a-block with brand new suitcases, and all of those full of all sorts of lovely things. And it was stopped by the guard. And the driver turned out to be Max Schmeling, who was heading north with his loot.
This is a famous heavyweight boxer.
That's right. Had been world champion. He beat Joe Louis. And so he was apprehended and sent back. And that was a highlight of that period, one of them. We spent a lot of time... in between miles, what you might call recreating. There was a lot of sport going on and a lot of riding. We got horses, we commandeered German horses, and there were some very good ones. So there was we were doing show jumping and things like that. And then we moved from there down to Itzehoe in the barracks, and life became much more formal, and we were back to beginning to be what you might call pre-war soldiers, as it were, regular army, hours of work and training.
Now, if you can move on a few years to the Korean War, can you tell me how and when you came to go to that war, please?
Yes, I was instructing officer cadets at Mons Officer Cadet School when I was informed that I was required to return to join the regiment to go to Korea. And the regiment came to Aldershot from Paderborn, where it had been stationed for, I suppose, 3 years. And we were in the barracks, in Talavera barracks in Aldershot, for, I suppose, September, October, about 2 months. And then we left on about the 31st of October to go to Liverpool to join the Georgic, which is a one-class immigrant ship. It wasn't a particularly comfortable ship from any angle, I don't think, but the great thing about it, it did have stabilizers, and so we were spared the worst excesses of storms, etc., when we encountered them.
And what was your role with the skins in Korea?
I was, first of all, second in command of A Squadron. And then when my squadron leader, a chap called Jeff Brundle Brown, went home to the Staff College in September, I took over command of the squadron.
What was the voyage in the Georgic like?
A very mixed experience. We travelled fairly comfortably. We had a very interesting captain called Snaky Williams, called Snaky because of his navigational skills. He seemed to get his ships into any other place that nobody else could. And he cruised as close to any points of interest on coastlines as he could to give us a little bit of entertainment. And on the boat we did various things which were supposed to help us. I mean, obviously the most important thing was physical exercise. So every day started with PT and running round the ship. And then it went on to weapon training and wireless training. And we were all told we had to learn the Morse code because it thought that communications in Korea would get so extended that the ordinary wireless telegraphy wouldn't work. So we had to practice our Morse. Never used, as it turned out, and one had grave doubts that it would. But we all were aiming to achieve at least 5 words a minute. I didn't. Although as a recruit I'd done it, I didn't do that very well. But then on top of that, we had shooting. And I was in charge of the shooting on the stern of the ship. And we had to devise all sorts of targets to shoot at. And I had various stratagems. We cast things overboard and shot at them. And I then got a great hawser and towed it behind with balloons on it. And they've quickly demolished the balloons. And the ones that weren't demolished by the gunfire were bobbed down to the water and instantly burst anyway. Then odd bits of furniture were towed with things on, which again provided fleeting targets. And then when we got nearer the China seas and that sort of, or any area than the Indian Ocean, I used to go down to the galley and get the cook to give me any sort of old offal that wasn't being used, the wastage stuff, and cast it overboard in the hope of attracting sharks to shoot at. It was a vain process, and the only shark we ever saw eventually was we were going into Hong Kong Harbour. The journey was broken by travelling through the Suez Canal, where we were hailed at various points along it by the Royal Dragoons, who were stationed there and contained many friends. And so they sort of waved us through. And then we got to Aden, and from Aden to Colombo, each of these stops we got ashore for a few hours, and then Colombo to Singapore. Singapore to Hong Kong, Hong Kong to Busan. And the Georgic was the largest ship that had ever entered Busan Harbour. But it went in with great dexterity, stirred by Snaky Williams. And that was that. And that was on about the 6th of December. No, was it the 2nd of December, I think it was.
What were your impressions of Busan?
Rather grim, I think. It was a barren sort of country, and we had to collect ourselves and really reorientate ourselves. I mean, a great shock from getting off the Georgic, which, with its gin and tonics and its and everything else, and except the last stretch from Hong Kong to Busan, during which the weather had got progressively colder, had been, on the whole, a fairly clement sort of trip. Then to be faced with the Korean winter, which is very severe, although we luckily were arriving as we did, arrived fully equipped to meet it, and we had, I should say, the best equipment in the whole of the Commonwealth Division, and I think our equipment was better than the Americans too, and the Canadians.
What was your equipment?
The normal parka, what they called a middle parka, which was an artificial sort of fur-lined garment, which was waterproof. and combat tunic and trousers, which were also waterproof, or more or less more than showerproof, and windproof, and with the hood that you could put on top, you could be nicely protected against the elements overall. Not if you're going to have, like an infantryman, have to sit out, or as a tank man on a vigil overnight within anything up to 50 degrees of frost. But it was good equipment, and we were ready for it. But coming straight off the Georgic and its various comforts, which looked even more comfortable from Poussin than they had when we were on board, was a shock. We then got onto a train which took us from there up to the railhead, rejoicing in the name of Wee John Boo. And we dismounted at the railhead and from there dispersed to what were going to be our initial stations. And in the space of a day, really, we had completely relieved the 8th Hussars. They had gone packing and we were in situ.
Did you get any advice from the 8th Hussars?
Oh, well, we had an advance party that had been there for a couple of months, possibly, and on site, yes, they gave us, and for instance, a troop leader would have the vulnerable points, or the central points pointed out on the opposition. And what I didn't mention was the journey north, and that in the train, was that, of course, it was exactly like First World War travel to the front, in that you had sort of eight horses and 30 men sort of idea. And we lived for 36 hours in a carriage with boards, and two levels of boards, and you slept on the boards, or if you could, you sat on the boards, and food was brought through in containers. That was a very uncomfortable journey, but through really very unremitting sort of countryside.
Can you tell me about taking up your positions in the line, please?
Well, yes, it went very smoothly. We just slotted in, and I can't really say much now. It just seemed to me that life didn't seem to change particularly. We were doing one thing, and the next thing we were doing was quite natural. You were observing enemy, supplying, bringing, covering patrols, and we just slotted into a routine which is, let's make it, unremarkable initially, anyway.
We haven't said anything about the equipment that you had, vehicles.
Well, we took over in situ the Centurion tank, which it was in its day a tremendous vehicle, great weapon of war. And the tanks were dug into positions on the hills, on strategic hills. And they stayed there. And only moved when the squadron changed round. If the squadron was going up to the line, it went into the slots that were vacated by the tank force you were relieving. And that was strange, because the whole atmosphere of that was practically First World War, static lines of defence. And the enemy, sometimes at one end of the front, only 300 yards away, another end of the front about 1,000 yards away. All absolutely static with their trenches and embedded positions. It was a very funny experience altogether. Well, funny is not the word for it, strange.
What was the main problem of operating in that way?
Well, mainly, I suppose, the weather. Whether it's extremely cold or extremely hot or extremely wet. But the fact that it really wasn't the proper role for tanks to be sitting in as sort of pillboxes, that was a difficulty. But it was just put great emphasis, of course, on gunnery, observation and gunnery. I can't think that there was much else to describe it, except that the areas that we occupied, say in the front line, were very vulnerable because they were in full view of the enemy. Much less so were they, because they were very largely infantry based. They had their field guns and things, but we didn't see them very much, and they didn't produce any armour. There was great excitement one day when they did produce a tank. But the positions that we occupied could be seen, and notably were occupied, as it were, and so therefore they attracted great attention from the Chinese artillery.
So what were the casualties in your particular unit?
Not as heavy as the infantry, and they seldom are, because anyway, aren't as many of us there. But I can't remember the exact one. I know, for instance, the day I was wounded, we had two killed and two others wounded. It was an extraordinary situation on the 26th of May, when, as far as we know, it was the first time that the Chinese had operated what the gunners would call a switch, where they had, what am I called, targeted some other place, ranged onto another target, and then just mathematically switched to another one. So, well, there was no question of any warning. We suddenly got the first, second, third, and fourth salvos and more of these heavy guns landing in a very small area of our squadron headquarters. And we were then parked in what you might call a re-entrant, which opened out to the bottom, and at the bottom were the general LAD area, the fitters and cookhouse and things like that. Although we didn't, when I say cookhouse, that's not the right expression, because we were all on vehicle cooking, but the general commissariat, the SQ mess and things, had his store or whatever he had there, and the supply vehicles. And this hit us with a tremendous bang. And I was sitting on wireless watch on my tank at the top of the reentrant. And I heard a scream. And as soon as the first lot of dust settled, I scrambled up and ran down to the bottom to see what had happened. And there was a great deal of destruction there. Lying in the ground was a marvellous little fellow called Corporal Brewer from the New Zealand Army, who had attached us. And he had just come in with this party from line laying, and he was really quite seriously wounded. He was mortally wounded, but he quite clearly looked terribly badly wounded. And I just looked around to see what else I could do for him, and then went round the corner of the Centurion, went nearby, to see a splendid little Corporal Newport, whose father had been a farrier sergeant major and a much loved, much respected member of the regiment before the war, and who had joined the skins. And then when the fitters were all converted into Remy, he became Remy. And there he was, as calm as you like, dressing the wounds of the other wounded. Because initially, I think everybody, and myself included, had assumed Brewer had been killed outright. It was only after I'd passed him and I looked back, and when I went back and next salvo fell, I dived underneath this same tank and I saw him move. And then I went to see, to do what I could for him, but he barely was on his way out, and there was nothing one could do. But Newport, with all this going on, was calmly dressing the wounds of the people who had survived. A wonderful, competent little man who, whether he was dealing with that or the machines or anything, he exuded enormous, or generated enormous confidence. That we lost touch. He doesn't belong to the Regimental Association, but he's a man I'd like to meet again, because he was absolutely outstanding.
What wounds did you have yourself?
I was only just slightly wounded in the leg. I was very lucky, in fact, because a shell splinter went across my eyebrow like that, until apparently recently, you could see the sort of white line. If it had been a fraction the other way, it would have been quite serious, I suppose.
Now, you'd arrived in that winter, 50-51, and you just described how you were wounded in May. What had been the sequence of events up till May?
Oh, well, sessions in the line, a small session in reserve, and then movement into the line. And roughly the pattern was you spent 2 months in the line and then you were relieved, and then you went back again after a spell, squadron by squadron. And I can't remember exactly what our general pattern, but in between whiles we had two armoured raids. One conducted on two on the same day, on the 16th of February, I think it was. 16th of February. Operations Liverpool and Ascot. And Liverpool was on the right, and Ascot was on the left. And Liverpool was done by elements from C Squadron, and supported by A Squadron. And Ascot was done by B Squadron. They say they were successful. I don't go quite under the terms of warfare how successful they were, but the tanks went across the valley and onto the far side and had encountered a certain amount of trouble and managed to get back in spite of boggings and the like. But B Squadron on the left were less successful. I don't think they got anywhere near where they should have got to, or where they were intended. Those two armoured raids.
What was your own part in?
Well, we were supporting fire from our hilltop positions. We had three principal features. Hill 210, point 159, which was on a spur sticking right out into no man's land and overlooked on three sides by the Chinese, which was the deadly spot of our front at that time. And on the extreme right, they had this very large hill, point 355, who was variously described as high hell, I think, or little Gibraltar. And that was the subject of various, or the target of various attacks by the Chinese. But all these points attracted increasingly heavy gunfire, and we noticed that as we were there, I think we noticed, and may have been just my impression, that their accuracy and skill developed in those 3 months. And one attributed that to the fact that they were getting Russian specialists helping them. But I think the switch was, not because it was a particular traumatic one for me, but I think the switch indicated just how they had developed, because suddenly they had to put that load of shells into one very small area without ranging. It was quite alarming. Later on, the general effect of the shelling was that it did get heavier. We noticed, and as we advanced into the autumn, we were getting some tremendous barrages. And on one occasion, prior to an attack on 355, the concentration of shells was likened by some people to the barrage at Alamein, which was historic. It was and much more concentrated because it came down on this particular hill, 355. And the Canadians were operating at the time. And it seemed as though the Chinese had got right under the feature the night before and camouflaged themselves, because they were very clever at doing that. And they came up in their ways. They overran the FDLs, but were eventually driven off. But it was an indication of what they could do. Their field craft was terrific, and their numbers, of course, were legion. And they were supported by such tremendous artillery. They could keep people's heads down while they, regardless of loss of life, would walk in through it or behind it. I think they probably did kill quite a number of their own people with their own barrage.
What was your opinion of the Chinese enemy in Korea?
One to be deeply respected, apart from their numbers, their skills, and their stoicism, and their use of camouflage, and their digging was amazing. One evening you might see a completely barren hillside. By dawn, you would see there'd been yards and yards of trench dug. They're amazing the way they, like human moles. And of course they did consolidate, and this is what they'd done, I think, really, in that bogus time when the peace talk started, and they stabilized along the 38th parallel or thereabouts. All that peace talk stuff was camouflage for consolidating a position which became, you can't necessarily say impregnable, but without using something like an atom bomb and shattering everything behind it, it would have been an extraordinarily costly business fighting through it.
Were there any civilians in the area?
A few. We didn't come across many. We employed, didn't see too many of them up in the front line. A bit behind you saw them, the peasants. We employed people as a labour force, who were quite useful carpenters and things like that. But on the whole, we didn't see a great number of Koreans, except in the back areas.
How did the Korean workmen perform?
Oh, they were very good. Very good at adapting, and so rather we use them for a variety of tasks, but principally building little bashes in reserve and works of that order. I can't remember what else we use them for, but they were very much in evidence, and the further we went back, the more they were used, but we didn't see much of them in the forward area.
How much was air power used?
Oh, a lot. We constantly saw the Air Force and the Americans going in. And what was amazing was the ground fire from the Chinese. One would have thought that they might have been invulnerable, because we had